Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Just get that out of the way. I just need y'all to strap in, settle down, and get your thinking cap on, because we're going to work your brain with my guest today. What up, what up? I'm Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. All right, look, as I said, y'all need to get ready, because what we're about to do is something we haven't done up in here before. And there's only one person I think I could do this with, and that is my guest, the one and only incomparable Professor Eddie Glaude. He is the James S. McDonald Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. He currently serves as President of the American Academy of Religion, so we can get into that. He has authored many books, the most recent of which we're going to talk about today, just released, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own, is currently on the New York Times bestseller list. My brother, and I can say this honestly, Eddie, because I listened to you, my mentor, Professor Eddie Glaude, welcome to the podcast.
I am so excited for this conversation. You know, this is great. And by the way, I'm no longer the president of the American Academy of Religion.
That's all right. Why'd they kick you out? Why'd they take
you? No, you know, you have your little term, and my term is over. So,
all right, so he's
I appreciate it.
He's former president. It's like being former chairman, right? The best title you can have is former.
Exactly.
So, okay, so this book, folks, and I'm going to talk about it a lot, and I want you to, again, put it on your list for end of summer reading, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America. Eddie, this book is different, and I want to start with a review by the New York Times, because I thought it was interesting the way Jennifer Szalai, I can't pronounce her last name, unfortunately, S-Z-A-L-A-I, to give her props. This is what she writes. Eddie Glaude Jr. Has published a blistering indictment of the Obama era, right? Under the watch of the first black president, Glaude wrote, quote, "Black people have suffered tremendously. Democratic machine that took black voters for granted had convinced Glaude that the only way forward would be an electoral blank out. He called on black Americans to turn out in record numbers again in November 2016 and cast a vote for, quote, none of the above. For Glaude, a Trump presidency was completely unfathomable until it actually happened. Quote, white America would never elect such a person in the highest office in the land, he writes. But then it goes on and it says, recalling what he told himself in 2016, Glaude writes, I was wrong. And given my lifelong reading of Baldwin, it was an egregious mistake. Mm-hmm. First off, I love it when folks own up, right? And state with clarity, hey, my bad, all right? But then what you did, which I thought was very interesting, you put it in the context of Baldwin. And how almost in a way you had almost dishonored his teaching, his mentorship, his understanding of the times as it relates to the day. What did you mean by that? How was that journey for you? Because a lot of folks kind of get lost in the whole thing about Obama and black folks in the vote. And that's a political discussion. You can always get into that, the right or wrong, up and down of that. But I took away from that part of the book and the way you described it. And I think this was actually what Jennifer was getting at, was that you actually were kind of spurred yourself to go back and revisit Baldwin, as you tell us to do the same thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think more than anything, as a lifelong reader of Baldwin, I just ran over the moment where he grappled with a choice. So many folk believe that Jimmy Carter was this kind of extraordinarily benign president, right? That he was great for black people. And to be honest with you, when you look at the record, Carter's policies of austerity had a really, really devastating impact on black urban communities. And the civil rights establishment, people mm-hmm. like Jesse and Andrew Young, who eventually was cast out. But Jesse and others said that Carter had betrayed them in
right.
some ways.
Right.
And so 79 actually shows a depressed turnout among black voters. And in fact, that depressed turnout in some ways helped Reagan into office in 1980. And Baldwin was grappling with, do we support Carter given what he's done? Or do we support Reagan? And for many black folk in this period, Reagan was as bad as George Wallace, because Reagan was the governor of California during the repression of the Black Panther Party. He was the governor right. of California when Angela Davis was placed on the FBI most wanted list, right? So Reagan wasn't the kind of, you know, shining knight who would redeem or make America great again. That's not how he was viewed in black communities. And so Baldwin made this point that, you know, black folk fought for the vote, and sometimes we realize that we have no one or nothing to vote for. And then he wrote this line that I'll never forget since I've made that mistake. So sometimes black folk have to vote in order to buy themselves some time. Mm-hmm. To buy themselves some time. And so here I was in 2016 thinking, you know, we have Jeb Bush is probably going to be the nominee for the Republican Party, and you have the Clintons doing what they're doing, and they just appointed, you know, she just asked Tim Kaine to come on with a backhand to the progressive side of the party, da 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 da. And I was just making the claim that, you know, making the point that, look, we are a captured electorate. We need to act differently in this political process, particularly coming out of the last 8 years of Obama, where we couldn't talk about race when we were getting our behinds handed to us by the Great Recession. We need to begin to figure out a way to really recalibrate, to really redefine how we act in the public domain. So let's hold the Democratic Party's fire, you know, feet to the fire.
Right.
And then when they nominated Donald Trump, I was like, oh, well, hell yes, we can really hold up to the fire, because there's no way these people are right. going to elect a man this incompetent.
Right.
And I should have known better.
But what does that say about America, bro? What does that say that you were so 180 degree off of that axis? And as a lot of people were, and how would Baldwin, in your understanding, look at that decision by the American people to do the thing that was so unfathomable?
You know, I'm always shy about trying to put words in his mouth, but I can say what he said about Reagan, because there's a similarity in the sense that both of them were Hollywood folks, right? Mm-hmm. Both of them are results of an attempt to reach for a certain kind of fantasy. And it has everything to do with the kind of clamoring for a white America, right? Doubling down on this idea that this is a white nation in the vein of Europe. So even those who voted for Obama in 2008 and who were still catching hell thought that Donald Trump could disrupt things. I think they in some ways said, well, hell, if it's going to be white and we're going to benefit, let's just benefit. So I think at the end of the day, all the demographic shifts that have been causing all this anxiety, you know, these racially ambiguous children on Cheerios commercials and this black man in the White House, just created this kind of racial anxiety that led people to say, hell no, we want this country to stay white. And so they voted for the man whose campaign began in some ways by insisting on a certain kind of voicing of whiteness, if that makes sense.
But how did
and that's the parallel, it seems to me.
Right, right. So how do you then walk that walk around those various narratives, whether it's, you know, Reagan in 67, I believe, when he becomes governor of California. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, flash forward to his actual presidency in 81, when he took office. And then, of course, you've got, you know, maybe under this Baldwinian narrative, the completion of that arc with Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, there are those of us like myself who, while there were aspects and features of Reagan's rhetoric and campaign in 1980 that were somewhat problematic, would look at the Democratic Party, as I did as a young man in the mid-1970s, and go, you represent me less than the other guy does. Mm-hmm. All right? Because you have not walked that walk. I'm not that far off of what you did, you know, with those Southern white Democrats before the 68 change with the Southern strategy. So there's all of these pieces that kind of play out in this narrative,
right?
That sort of culminate with Trump in 16. And how does Begin Again speak to those current conditions that are really kind of born out of the Southern strategy and the sort of, you know, the still ugly underbelly of American culture and economy and so forth as it relates to the impact on Black folks, and what we see now as still, you know, ongoing systemic racism that we see culminated in the knee on the neck and Breonna Taylor, et cetera, et cetera.
Such a great question, and such a hard question in some ways. But, you know, the ghosts that continue to haunt our body politic. You know, from the moment I can remember remembering, race has animated so much of the political decision making and policy making of this country. And so here we are in this moment. It's kind of a moral reckoning of mm-hmm. sorts. Where the nation faces a choice of whether or not it's going to be a truly multiracial democracy, or whether it's going to double down on the idea, as I said in Democracy in Black and as I echo here in Begin Again, on this idea that white people matter more than others. So the through line of American history, Mike, is, to my mind, is this belief that white people matter more than others, and how that belief shapes our dispositions, informs our practices, organizes our social, political, and economic arrangements. And that belief takes shape differently under different material conditions. So what does it mean to believe that white people matter more than others in the context of slavery is going to look very different than in the context of Jim Crow. It's going to look different in the context of a Black president. It's going to look different in the context of Trumpism. But it's the through line. It's the consistent thing. And so every time we have an opportunity to really change, to rid ourselves of this ugly undertow in our politics, we double down on the ugliness. We double down on the belief. And so in the book, I talk about two preceding moments. One was the second founding. That's the Civil War and Radical Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. They try to do our first works over, and we get the modern U.S. nation state. We get a notion of citizenship that's not tethered to race in that period. What did we get in response? We got Jim Crow, segregation in the South. I mean, Frederick Douglass lived long enough to see Lincoln sign the Emancipation Proclamation, and the state of Mississippi passed the first Jim Crow law. He dies the year before Plessy versus Ferguson is rendered. We also get, you know, convict leasing, another form of slavery. How, you know, and you think about how else did cities like Birmingham get built and the like, right? So that's one moment where we double down on our ugliness and arrested an opportunity for us to change. You think about the mid-20th century. You know, what did we get in response to the civil rights and Black Power movement? We got calls for law and order, and that's not just simply a Republican story.
Right.
We got calls for law and order, which put in place the, you know, that cornerstone for the carceral state that has devastated Black and brown communities in this country. We got the tax revolt in California. We could talk about that, but we got that tax revolt that then kind of led us to shred in some ways the social safety net. We could talk about what that means. Again, the country doubled down on its ugliness. We elect a black president. What did we get? We got the vitriol of the Tea Party. We got voter ID laws. We got voter suppression. And then we vomited up Donald Trump.
So there was so professorial to that last point, and then you got street.
But what I'm saying is that in each of those moments, we had a chance to be otherwise. And so here we are in a moment now where we have a chance to be otherwise, and we're already seeing clamoring for the lie, as it were. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, because you open up a very important door I think black folk have to walk through, and I think it actually will set some of the platform of some of what's in my head that I want to share with you and get your thoughts on as we progress in this conversation around us. My genesis when it comes to the black conversation, first and foremost, is always with us. All right. So that conversation, you can have it and do all that. And that's an important piece, very important piece, I think. And let's set that aside for the moment, because what you're talking about right now is that no matter what that conversation is about us, amongst us, we still then have to go out and deal with white folks who are changing the nature of the game. So at every moment where we get a leg up, they cut off a toe. You know, when we get our foot on the platform, they decapitate the foot. You know, there's always some pain that's going to be greater than the effort that you then have to overcome, and which is basically what you said. And there's a point in the book in which you talk about after the death of Malcolm, after the death of King, Stokely Carmichael is throwing out, you know, black power, sort of elevates this idea of black power. And then you go on and you say, quote, "Ever since the first journey to the American South, Baldwin understood exactly what his calling required, even when the times became dark and sullen. Quote, I think I really understood, and probably for the first time, that what you're doing as a writer or any kind of artist," and I took that to mean basically as a black person, "was not designed to, make you special or to even isolate you. What your role was, it seemed to me, was to bear witness to what life is, does, and to speak for people who cannot speak, that you are simply a kind of conduit." And these individuals were those conduits for us, that they understood what their role was. And that's something that Baldwin, I think, came to understand about these lives and these men and women and the roles they play. He would then go on to speak to Fern Marja Ekman and say, quote, "You're at the mercy of something which has nothing to do with you, nothing to do with your career, nothing to do with your ambitions, nothing to do with your loneliness, nothing to do with your despair. It had to do simply with the division of labor in the world." And so I see these two pieces that at once sort of call you to bear witness and to speak to the moment and to understand what your role is, but at the same time recognizing that what you're engaging in ultimately has nothing to do with you. It really rests with the problem that white folks have.
Yeah, that's, you know, in some ways, that's the revolutionary inversion at the heart of Baldwin's corpus. The problem ain't us.
Right.
Never has been.
Which brings me, and I got here sooner than I probably thought I would, which brings me to, as I mentioned to you, what I thought was the definition of the Baldwinian narrative in this book. And if I could, does folks know it's on page 106.
I'm right there. That's scary. Go ahead.
And it says, and I'm going to use the words of Baldwin, folks, so don't y'all go freaking out, all right, because this is the man speaking. "We have invented the nigger. I didn't invent him. White people invented him. I've always known. I had to know by the time I was 17 years old that what you were describing was not me. what you were afraid of was not me. It had to be something else. It had invented, you had invented it, so it had to be something you were afraid of and you invested me with. I've always known that I'm not a nigger. But if I'm not the nigger, and if it's true that your invention reveals you, then who is the nigger? I'm not the victim here. So I give you your problem back. You're the nigger, baby. It isn't me. I was like, hello. Hello. Because that speaks to so much of what I see evolving out of the postmortem of the George Floyd murder. That is, as I'm seeing it play out, a lot of what at least the younger generation of black folk are saying, this ain't my problem. This is your problem. And I'll be damned if you go, you put it on my great granddaddy's back. You put it on my great grandmama's back. You put it on my grandfather's back. You put it on my parents' back. You're not putting this on my back because this ain't my problem. It's your problem. And when you take these two pieces, you kind of come to this point where you realize I have a role to play, but that role really ain't got anything to do with me. It gets you to this point where you say, wait a minute, hold up. Let me check this. This is white folks messed up shit. This ain't my shit. This is their shit. Why am I burdened with this for 401 years?
Right. And so, you know, part of the, you know, there's this moment, you know, in the book, I talk about this in the book where, you know, he's meeting with these Howard students, students who were activists in SNCC, who were Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who were part of the national the Nonviolent Action Group, NAG, at Howard's campus, on Howard's campus. And Baldwin is there for a conference, and then he's chopping it up with them in an apartment late at night. And as the sun's coming up, he says, you know, you promise your elder brother, if you promise your elder brother that you never believe, that you will never believe what the world says about you, then I promise you I'll never betray you. Now, why does he ask that? Because he knows that part of the game is to get us to believe what the world says about
us. That's it. That's it. That is so much truth.
And so once we believe it, then we're done. We're caught. We're trapped. And so the inversion is at the heart of the corpus, right? The problem isn't us. The problem is you. And then you're projecting all of that stuff on me. And then I have to bear it. I have to bear the burden of it, right? It's like, you know, I write this line right above the passage you read. Baldwin maintained that navigating this contradiction was the true Negro problem, not a problem of black people, but a problem for black people presented by the problem with white people.
Amen.
The fact that we have to work so hard to prevent this nonsense from taking root in our children has little to nothing to do with us, he argued. It is a consequence of white America's problem. So we have to raise our children in this environment. We have to try to figure out how to imagine the good in this environment. And we've done it over generations. Now, the early Baldwin is like, okay, given what I've just made, this revolutionary move, we got to love them in such a way that maybe we can help them see themselves differently.
But don't they want to be helped?
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. Once they kill King.
Yeah, okay.
Baldwin goes, oh, hell no, because he loses it. He collapses, tries to commit suicide in 1969.
Yeah.
And so Michael Thelwell says his we changed. You know, the nature of his we changed. And that is, because Baldwin makes this distinction, Mike, and it's a distinction that I love. He makes it in The Evidence of Things Not Seen, a book about the Atlanta child murders that was published in 1987. And I think 87, something like that. And the basic claim is there's a difference between white people and those people who happen to be white. And he says, and I agree with, I say this, I happen to love a lot of people who happen to be white, and then they're white people.
Right. That's so true.
And that distinction matters.
It does matter.
The those who happen to be white are those who are engaged in an ongoing critical reflection on how racism comes to them as easy as language. They're engaged in the work of trying to build a more just world. They see human beings right in front of them in all of their complexity, and they want to be seen in all of their complexity. They don't believe in some mamby-pamby sentimental notion that we're all human beings. We all come with mess. and we're trying to work through that mess. And then there's white folk, those are the people who are invested in advantage and disadvantage being distributed along the lines of who's valued and who's devalued. Those people who believe that the world should be organized to reflect the value gap, right? Mm-hmm. Baldwin wants to say, I don't want to spend my time trying to convince those white folk that they should be otherwise. I want to spend my time trying to build a more just world where those beliefs have no quarter to breathe.
Right. That's it.
And that's the Baldwin that I'm trying to put forward as my walking partner as we think about this moment. That's why you're so prescient to recognize what these young folk, at least some of them, are saying in this moment. You're not going to put this on me. Right. This is on you.
This is on you. And I really want folks to take to heart that point and the point you made before about the difference between white people and everybody else. Because in my household, that, you know, you see certain things, you hear certain things, you see certain events, and they're just two words that describe it completely. White people.
White folk.
And no one has to say anything else. And it's not a smack at, you know, white folks who are walking that walk with us at all. It is really in a political sense, for to put that context around it, those white folks that are part of that bargain from 1968. Those white mm-hmm. folks that are part of that bargain with Trump today, those white folks who were part of that bargain, and you know, during Reconstruction, that oh hell no, we're not gonna rebuild this country in their image,
right?
All right,
they're the ones who always have the potential. You know, they're the ones who have the baby by the throat, right?
All the time,
all the time,
all the time. And so, it's important, I think, to sort of put all of this in the right perspective and not have the emotional reaction that white folks have, okay, mm-hmm. Sometimes, well, all the time. And it calls to mind, and I would love to see how you would think, how you think, but how you also think, not to put words in his mouth, obviously, James Baldwin would interpret the 1619 Project, because that project was sort of, again, one of those efforts that said, you know what, we're not going to let you redefine our history. We're not mm-hmm. going to let you start history from, oh, you know, white folks struggled to get to these shores and, you know, collectively built this great nation.
Right.
Meanwhile, yeah. There are the bodies of Native Americans over there. There are black folks out in the fields plowing corn. I mean, you know, so what? How does that sort of, and it's that articulation of history, not a revision of history, an articulation of history, mm-hmm. set in the context of this idea of beginning again?
Oh, it's absolutely key. Because the lies we tell ourselves about who we are, right, block the way to us becoming something otherwise. Mm-hmm. So when we tell the story of America as the shining city on the hill, as an example of democracy achieved, as the redeemer nation, what we do in effect, right, is that we justify our willful ignorance, we justify our feigned innocence, right, about what we've done. And when we tell a story about our actual history, when we tell the story about our failures, our ghastly failures, and we join those with our aspirations for a more just world, then we open ourselves to a different way of being in the world. So what do I mean? So the 1619 Project, as complicated as it is, I mean, because it raises a whole host of questions. Mm-hmm. For a number of reasons, but what it did at its core was to say, what happens when we begin the country, not in Plymouth Rock, but in Jamestown? Oh, America becomes, oh, if we begin in Jamestown, we're a corporation before we're a country. Hmm. Mm-hmm. If we begin in Jamestown, what does that mean? Oh, Native Americans, slaves, they're all part of the story. It's a failed experiment in some ways when we begin there. So we get a different kind of narration. So part of the work of telling a different kind of story is to disrupt this idea, Michael, that racial justice is a philanthropic enterprise. That is something that white folk, remember the distinction, audience, that right. white folk give to others. Right. We want to disrupt it. We don't want to be invited to the table. We help build the damn table. It's ours.
It is.
It's alongside yours.
Oh,
right.
Oh, my God, it is. Yes.
So part of the work of the 1619 Project is to create the conditions for a debate around a different kind of story, not where, you know, charity is inviting us to the table. Well, no, where America's always been a mosaic of peoples. Right, where the idea of democracy itself has always been fraught by our contradictions.
Well, and that you raise a very interesting sort of riposte to the thrust of your initial argument about America being that shining city on the hill. Can't we be? And I, for one, have given many a speech over my many years in politics. That talk about America in that context, but have always included myself and my community in it. All right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think for some, they see that bright, shining city on a hill with, you know, just white light bulbs.
Right.
That's what makes it shiny. And I'm like, nah, you know, have you ever been in the basement back in the day? And someone turned on that red light. Yeah, okay, baby, now we're talking. It's a different color. It sets a different mood. It's you know, part of changing the nature of things, and that's what that's what happens. So why can you have a situation? Can't we still be, for example, that shining city on a hill as America, at the same time acknowledging our original sin of slavery? And what we did to sort of build this country on the backs and the deaths of Native Americans, for example. So right. Is there a space for that, or do you have to completely, you know, wash yourself of that sin before you can claim that light?
I think so. I think it's the latter, Michael. I think it's
so. Do that?
And then this is the hard work. I mean, hopefully it doesn't require us to wander for 40 years and generations to die. But
right. But
the point is this: when we imagine ourselves as the shining city on the hill, we have a very efficient ideology to turn our attention away from our sins. So it's part what happens as in a certain kind of perfectionist American story. Is that, yes, we had slaves, but look, we don't have them anymore. Yes, women couldn't vote. Yes, children used to have to work. Yes, we slaughtered Native peoples. Yes, but look, we're not doing that anymore. We're always on the road to a more perfect union. The shining city on the hill works as a metaphor to kind of ensure the inherent goodness of our character. And the one thing, you know, just to put it in Christian terms, right? Mm-hmm. The one thing that we can't forget is how fallen we are.
Right.
And so Shining Hill talk is a very different kind of talk, right? So part of what I'm thinking, part of what I do is to say, let's put aside the shining city on the hill and let's just talk about a more just America.
Yeah, but you can do both, Eddie. I mean, that's
I'm trying to suggest to you that is the way, what I'm trying to suggest though, Mike, is that the way in which the ideology of the shining city on the hill works, it becomes a constitutive feature of our understanding of ourselves as Americans, which block the way to us dealing with, honestly, slavery and what we've done with Native peoples and the like. That's why you're such an outlier.
Well, but yeah, well, okay. Yeah, you know, and I get your argument, but to follow with the Christian theme here, as a Catholic, I know I'm sinful. As a Christian, I know that. And as a Catholic, we have a process of dealing with that sinfulness. At the same time, acknowledging the grace-filled person that we are because God loves us and imbued us with. So we don't sit there and turn that light within ourselves off until we cleanse out that sin because we know we will sin again. So it is always this striving towards that more perfect person, following the value construct that the man known as Jesus came to this earth to give us, all right, as the way, the truth, and the life. And he did not say that the only way you can get there is once you stop sinning. He recognized that. So as a country, we kind of fall into that same space where there is value in saying to others, look, we stopped these sinful ways, and yet we still sin through Jim Crow and these other things. And yet now we find ourselves in that repentive moment, that reflective moment where we're trying to atone for that. But that doesn't diminish the light. It doesn't mean that ideal is less, that we still can't talk about that ideal. I take your point. What I'm saying is, let's flip it a little bit and say, now as we talk about that shining city on a hill, let's also acknowledge the sin. And because in acknowledging that sin, we make that light brighter and stronger, because what we then say in the next breath will have more resonance and value and meaning because we first acknowledge the sin.
So part of what I hear you, part of what I'm arguing is that the way in which we have evaded our sins has been principally rooted in this understanding of America as uniquely charged, as America as the Redeemer Nation, this example of democracy achieved.
See, now, so I would believe it is.
I don't believe it is, because when we look at the practices— Right. So when we look at what we've done, I don't believe in the Gurner Myrdal American dilemma distinction, right? That Americans' ideals are fine. It's just we've got to align our practices with our ideals. And for Myrdal, that meant getting the South in line. I'm like, nah, that's, you know, you exceptionalize the Southern region, as Malcolm says.
No, I'm saying you get the country in line. You get the country in line. You can't just—
No, so part of what I'm saying is that when we look at our history, our practices reveal what we believe. Our practices reveal what we have believed. And so part of—
But that's not true for all folk, though.
Oh, it's true for the country's history generally. Absolutely. That's
why, but if our practices reveal what we believe, then we would not have made the progress that we've made. We'd still be in a world of Jim Crow, because that was the practice. We'd still be three-fifths of a person.
Right.
So you give no quarter for—
I'm not denying that there's not a tradition.
No, I'm saying, but are you giving quarter for people to make that, to have that revelatory moment?
Oh,
where they say, damn, that's not consistent with these ideals that we inscribe on the pillars above our criminal, our court system and our economic, you know what I'm saying?
Right. So, you know, there's, you know, in my first book, way back when,
long time ago,
right? It's been 20 years since that book came out. I'm grappling with what the late Zach Van Berkovich calls the American ideology, where every argument that's had is an argument about and over America, and it's defined by the terms of American exceptionalism, which then limits and constricts how one imagines critique. And so what I'm trying to figure out in my work, and this is too abstract for a short conversation, is how do we get out of that cycle so that we can actually bring the sort of critique that would dislodge, our imagining, our self-imagining, from this ideology that actually blocks us from seeing our sins, right? From actually dealing with them, from thinking of the sins as just momentary blips, as it were, as opposed to essential evidence of who we are. Because that to say that this is an example of who we are is not to say that— to say at the same time that we can't be otherwise.
No, I got you, Professor. But this is what I would do in answer to your book.
Okay.
All right. I would hold that sin up against that light. I would hold that sin up and like the scales of justice, like that balance, that delicate balance between that your mama taught you, between right and wrong and all of that. I would weigh them. I would have the country weigh it. I would have the country confront them both at the same time. And part of this is the friggin' failure of our leaders, who have so corrupted their own ideology, their own philosophies, their own view of America, that system of balance is harder to achieve, and therefore the weight of that sin becomes compounded, even greater, because we don't have the Baldwins who are sort of putting a light on that. We don't have the Martin Luther Kings who are putting a light on that. We don't, and that's why I love your book, and that's why I have such admiration for you, because you are that modern day. In fact, I was going to tweet out at some point, and I got distracted. I didn't send the tweet, so I'm going to say it on the air. You are the modern day James Baldwin. You are the person who are trying to contextualize these moments.
Wow.
And put them in a real space so people can see it. That light is exposed, the good light and the bad light, the darkness and the light coming together. And so saying, and you asked the question on Morning Joe as I've asked the question on Morning Joe. In fact, I asked this very same question in 2018, the weekend before the election. I put it into political terms, what kind of government do you want and what kind of leaders do you want to lead it? You asked the more important, broader question shortly before this book came out on air, and you looked at the nation and said, what kind of country do you want to be? Mm-hmm. What kind of people do you want to be in this country? Which goes to the essence of how we begin again.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. I'm going to let everybody take a moment because this has been a lot. We're going to take a couple of minutes here. When we come back, I got some, we'll get a little bit more into some politics. We'll put Baldwin in on a political test right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. All right, let's just jump back in this thing. We're talking with Eddie Glaude and the great book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. So, how, Eddie, do you see, this moment as we are now 3.5 months out from a national election in which the choice for the presidency couldn't be any starker? I mean, it just couldn't, in my view. How do you see the response to Black Lives Matters? The scenes that we see playing out in Portland, these gravitational forces that are really pulling at the very thing that we were just talking about, pulling at that light and that dark, pulling at the American spirit, some wanting to draw them back into this racist past around this imagery of making America great again, right? Mm-hmm. And those who want to push past that and move forward into a future in which we recognize sort of, you know, at least in terms of Black folks, the Baldwinian view that the problem isn't me, it's you.
Yeah.
So how do you see us sort of beginning to deal? Because you're not reconciling at this moment. We're just starting to begin to deal with this understanding and appreciation of exactly what's before us. And how do you think Americans will look at that and in response to what they've seen so far?
Well, you know, we're on a knife's edge, man. In so many ways, you know, people are, I mean, you said it the other day on Morning Joe, you know, that this might be his plan.
Yeah.
Right. What we don't let folks don't sleep. This might be the plan, and he has don't assume because the national polls are what they are that he doesn't have a chance. It's not like the divisions that defined the political landscape in 2016 have just simply disappeared because of COVID-19. They're still here, so we're on a knife's edge, you know. And in some ways, the country has to grapple with a dangerous set of choices. One, of course, is Donald Trump and Trumpism. The other is safety, the illusion of safety, that we can just go back to what was. And I think either choice will be the source of our ruin. And then there's this idea you know, because we're hearing it, if I'm answering your question correctly, that we're hearing it, this clamoring for a kind of view of the nation as white, right? That's the, you know, every time we have a chance to give birth to a new America, the umbilical cord of white supremacy wraps itself around the neck of the baby.
Yes, yes.
And chokes the life out of it, you know? And, you know, we have a generation of children, generation of young people, millennials and Gen Zers, or however we want to describe them, who have all kind of come to the conclusion that America is fundamentally broken because they're a generation raised in catastrophe. Right, from climate change to Great Recession to mass shootings in schools to police murders to great to global pandemic. Mm-hmm. We can go down the line, right? So they've come to the conclusion that the place is broken and they're grappling grasping for something different. Some are reaching for progressive policies, some are reaching for authoritarian fascist policies. I keep telling people Boogaloo Boys aren't baby boomers.
No, they're not.
Dylann Roof wasn't a baby boomer.
Wasn't a baby boomer. No.
Right. So we're on a knife's edge. And so, you know, there's no guarantee where we're going to end up. Our history suggests that we're not going to do well. But, you know, there's this line I quote in the book from Samuel Beckett, you know, fail, fail, fail again and fail better.
So, yeah, fail better. Yeah. Well, and that kind of sort of brings me to the back end of the pen that I put in the front end of our conversation about how I've approached my journey as an African-American. You know, I think one of the things that stunned the hell out of a lot of insiders inside the GOP was that they actually woke up and realized, damn, we elected a real black man.
Exactly. I saw that. I saw it up close. Right?
Because he's out here saying shit we didn't know. Did he say that when he was running for chairman? Yeah, he did. Because he did it when he was lieutenant governor and when he was county. So it's always been part of my narrative not to forget about us, that to put us at the beginning of the conversation. And I'm right now having that fight with some things going on in town because, yet again, black folks, as we're looking at stimulus money that's being doled out around the country, we're looking at the impact of COVID-19 on communities around the country. We are put at the back of that conversation. And at some point, we as black folks have got to get tired of that. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. Please tell me when that moment is. Now, if there's a meeting that we need to have, I'm first to sign up. Okay, I'm there. I want to be in that room and to have that conversation. And it goes, Eddie, to what we were talking about early in the book, where what is it about the Revolutionary Act, as you refer to it, that blacks haven't embraced this Revolutionary Act in a way to not only state without hesitation, the problem ain't us, but while you're thinking about how you're going to solve your problem, this is what we want in the meantime, to put out our demand, because how much more of the educational system that they put our kids in, mm-hmm. The redlining of our neighborhoods, the gentrification. How many grandmamas have lost their homes with, you know, or not right. lost because they were paid pennies on the dollar,
right?
Not
right.
nickels or dimes on the dollar, but pennies on the dollar for their home. And, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, white folks, oh, this is a great neighborhood, right? So at what point do we take control of that narrative and commit to that Revolutionary Act that Baldwin talks about and that you talk about, to say to the broader communities, I don't care who they are, white, black, Hispanic, I don't care who they, you know, that this is us. This is what we demand after 401 years of building this country, of making it that shiny city on the hill. Yeah, we were the one holding the light, okay? Just so everybody's clear, right? How do we do that?
You know,
And does Baldwin get into that at all?
You know, Baldwin, at his most desperate moments, he still held the view that, you know, that he still believed in the New Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. He still believed that we could do the work together to build a more just, not only a more just America, but a more just world where we stood in right relation with one another. And, you know, for him, the most powerful force to make that happen would be love. But that's a different conversation for a different time. Right. But I think in terms of your practical question, it requires of us to break from frames. We have to break loose from the traditional American racial theater. We have to break loose from the typical way in which we engage in party politics. We have to reimagine the importance of the local, the state, as arenas for organizing, for activism. We have to understand the vote within the broader context of what a vibrant democratic life entails, right? We need to understand what Baldwin meant when he said, do your first works over. Mm. When he, because, you know, at the end of his, you know, he was not only saying begin again, he was quoting Revelations chapter 2, verse 5. Right. Trying mm-hmm. to get us to see what it meant to go back and tell the story about our journey to now that would orient us to the world differently. So part of what we have to do is change the frame. We have been fighting, at least to my mind, we have been fighting on a set of certain terms. And whether those terms involve thinking that the problem is us, or whether those terms involve a political field that presumes that we are the objects of charity, or whether that term involves that we have to just simply wait for and argue over crumbs, wait for the invitation to the table, right? One of the things we have to do is just simply just reject the framing of how we engage in arguing about the nature of this place, it seems to me. And we need languages, vocabularies for that to happen, for us to have it so that people can describe their circumstances differently, so they can describe their attitude and orientation differently. And all I know is this, and this is where the source of the title of the book came from, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
In these moments of crisis, and when the country turns its back on us, when it betrays us again and again and again and again, and we have to figure out how to push this damn boulder up the hill again, right? Just for our children's sake and their right. children's sake. Baldwin says, when the dream was shattered and people lost their minds, some were murdered, right? Some had to flee, you know, we knew what happened. We knew what we did. But responsibility is not lost. Responsibility is abdicated. And if one refuses abdication, one begins again. And so if we take the revolutionary action, the revolutionary inversion seriously, if we understand that our civic energy is finite, we will spend all of our energy trying to build a world where the noxious racist commitments don't hold any quarter, can't have any quarter to breathe. And at the end of the day, understand that it ain't in us. And let me say this, in Black Power, Baldwin makes this wonderful formulation. He says, when Black folk step outside of the orbit of expectation of white America, then we're talking revolution. When we step outside of the orbit of expectations of how we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to act, how we're supposed to grieve, how we're supposed to suffer, how we're supposed to be silent in the face of all of this injustice, when we step outside of the orbit of those expectations, then we are on the road to fundamentally changing how this place is, what it is, if that makes sense.
Oh, brother, it does. I was going to end with a quote from the conclusion of the book in which you talk about a new America. You just did. Better than the quote that I was going to pull that I was touched by.
Because please read it. Please
I don't know if I could top your own words with your own words.
Okay, that's good.
No, but it's you say, and I know you've got to get out of here because you got other stuff to do. Mm-hmm. This has been such a powerfully good conversation for me personally, and I'm hoping everyone is feeling and got out of it what I'm feeling and getting out of it. You say in the conclusion, under the title "A New America." Quote, Americans must walk through the ruins toward the terror and fear and lay bare the trauma that we all carry with us. So much of American culture and politics today is bound up with the banal fact of racism in our daily lives and our willful refusal to acknowledge who benefits and who suffers from it. Underneath it all is the lie that corrupts American life. It corrupts how we imagine governance, how we think about our private lives, constraining even who we can love, mm-hmm. how we can imagine community and the broader public good. It even tells us which voters matter. The lie is the lifeblood of Trumpism. Anything that does not corroborate its reality is dismissed as fake news. Anyone who doesn't fit the view of America as a white nation or refuses to submit to it, refuses to submit to it, is cast as a traitor or mm-hmm. someone who hates America. Mm-hmm. And that, folks, is the obstacle to a new America.
Yes, indeed.
If we allow ourselves to believe the lie. So that is Professor Eddie Glaude, folks. That's why this book was important to me personally and why I needed this brother on for the time I've had him today. Just as a personal note so folks know, the first time I saw Professor Glaude, I wanted to have an intellectual fight with him. I wanted to just whip him from one side to the other because he was so wrong in my view. And when I got to actually have a conversation with him, Eddie will tell you, we've sat on couches in lobbies of hotels.
Right? Indeed.
and gone at it. And what I love about what you do is you don't say, I'm right, you're wrong. You just say, have you ever thought about? Have you ever looked at it this way? Have you ever considered? And when we stop doing that, folks, we lose sight of the opportunity to have a conversation, to understand that there are points of view that are different from our own. And that is what, at the end of the day, has made men like Baldwin and makes men like Eddie Glaude. Because they do that. They get us to think. This book, Begin Again, is a thinker. It makes you think. It makes you appreciate it very much as the reviewer of your book in the New York Times said. He spurs you to revisit Baldwin's work. And I would say that Eddie Glaude makes you think about your own thoughts, too. And Eddie, I appreciate you, brother. I really do, man. This has been such a joy having you on the podcast.
Man, it's my pleasure. Thank you. I'm so blessed to walk this journey with you, Doc.
Amen to that. Amen to that. So, folks, go out, get your copy of Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own by the incomparable Eddie S. Glaude, Jr. Certainly, when you get a moment, you want to share this podcast with your friends and family. Have them download us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts on. You know we love you when you do that. Stay safe. Stay well out there. Put the damn mask on. All right? Don't be stupid. And we'll catch y'all next time on the Michael Steele Podcast. Later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.